CBD Revolution. The world is discovering CBD and its potential for numerous health benefits. Hemp Fusion Wellness is the premier company looking at CBD with a whole food perspective. For the highest quality CBD oils and products for stress, sleep, energy, and topicals, it's Hemp Fusion. This CBD Revolution highlight has been brought to you by Hemp Fusion Wellness, U.S. trading symbol CBDHF, and in Canada, CBD.U. Web address, hempfusion.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Patrick Tucker, the technology editor for Defense One. The M of Defense One has the Q of Defense One, and we're talking to Q's apprentice because we're going to the world of cyber, but there are many twists to this road, and we begin with the suspicion of ransomware and the Russian Federation. Patrick, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The distinction you make between hacking by the Chinese bad actors, that would be the People's Republic of China, and hacking or cyber espionage or cyber bad behavior by the Russian Federation bad actors. What is the general sense of these two states that now and again present themselves as allies, but they have different styles? Good evening to you.
Good evening. So they are very different, and the U.S. government is taking a very different approach to both of them because they represent very different sorts of threats. The Chinese government is perhaps the greatest practitioner of traditional espionage using cyber means outside of the United States, and really it's kind of a coin toss as to which is superior. It sort of depends on what metrics you use. But when we say traditional espionage, we mean breaking into a system, stealing information, but not necessarily using it to disrupt the targeted entity, to destroy the system, something like that. The Chinese use this to steal intellectual property, things like designs for military aircraft that then resulted, you know, a few months or years later in Chinese aircraft, drones, systems, tools, products, et cetera, that look surprisingly like something that a Western firm was creating. But it's very traditional. The Biden administration and the U.S. government, actually going back several administrations, have been increasingly focused on bad action out of Russia that represents a different sort of threat. So think back to the Colonial Pipeline event that happened in the spring, where you had what was called a group of cyber criminals, but they were working out of Russia. They performed a ransomware attack where basically they hit a targeted company, they shut down their computers, and they demand ransom in Bitcoin or some other cryptocurrency to release it. The problem is that you can't attack that entity in the same way you would attack a state. But they do work sort of hand in hand with Russian authorities. And this is something that the Biden administration and the Defense Department Deputy Defense Secretary for Cyber Policy, Mika Ouyang, talked about with a group of reporters. So in essence, what you've got is a situation a lot like the privateers of the 18th century, if you are at all familiar with naval history. These were called pirates with papers. And they basically had kind of license from whichever government they were from to go out and raid ships. They got to keep the bounty. And the government benefited because their adversary was still attacked. But it wasn't quite the same as an act of war. It wasn't the same as a state-sponsored attack. So this is the big difference. Secretary Ouyang acknowledged that it's kind of an open question how much influence Vladimir Putin has over these groups, even though they're doing the bidding of the state. And part of the reason for that is the deep corruption that exists within the Russian government. Many of these actors that attack Western targets with these ransomware schemes, not to steal information, but to get a little bit of money and disrupt a business process and break something. They have deep connections to the Russian government, the FSB, often the GRU, military in particular, because most of them have military training. They actually often work cybersecurity contracts for the Russian government, and they do a little moonlighting on the side. So what the Biden administration is focused on now is getting the Putin regime to end that moonlighting practice. But of course, it's a very open question that whether or not they will. There's Not a lot of indication that they have any interest in that, because again, these groups are essentially attacking targets that exist within an adversarial country. But some of these groups, like DarkSide, that group that attacked Colonial Pipeline in the spring, have disappeared. So there may be some progress there, or it may be cosmetic. They may be rebranding as something else. But it's a level of murkiness that you don't see with Chinese actors, which directly respond to this state.
Patrick, taking us to the letter of mark of the 18th century, the blessed pirates, who sometimes used to be the members of the Royal Navy or the French Navy as well. So now we go to a recent incident that looks quite threatening. Then again, the news came from the Financial Times in these last days that China had successfully tested a hypersonic missile that had been fired into orbit, circled the globe, and struck its target, immediately not on top, but certainly. The quote that I remember from the article was, "We have no idea how they did this." First, Patrick, I want to make certain we've confirmed that this test took place. Do we have any more information since then?
We don't have a ton of information. The military officials that I spoke to did confirm that what they had read and what they had seen was very troubling. The Chinese government insists that the thing that they were testing was actually a space vehicle and not a missile, but it's certainly useful as a missile. And you don't generally launch a space vehicle off of a plane and then use it to hit a target on the ground if it's supposed to carry people. Not generally what you do. This is what's called a hypersonic glide vehicle. So there's a lot of different types of hypersonic weapons of the new variety. Anything that moves five times the speed of sound is a hypersonic, and traditional ICBMs fall into that category, but they're much easier for the U.S. to defend against because you know about where they're going, you know about where the target is, and they follow a predictable azimuth. This is an entirely new breed of potentially, you know, World War III causing missile that can maneuver as it's descending to Earth and can strike any target basically between, I'm told from former military officials, between Maine and Alaska. Very difficult to defend against, very difficult to intercept because it maneuvers on the way down. This is what China tested. And folks that I talked to said that, you know, in looking at the capabilities of what China can do, you really have to look straight to the edges of physics, like really the edges of what thermodynamics will allow and beyond what you think technologically they're capable of, because this did kind of wound a lot of people's expectations of how far along China was on their path to developing and deploying new hypersonic weapons. And it really speaks to a change in the whole art of deterrence and game theory as applied to nuclear weapons. This new sort of technology shows that you don't have to get into a race with the United States just to deploy warheads by number. The number isn't really the issue. It's if you have a delivery vehicle that is as devastating as this in terms of how difficult it is to defend against, you don't need as many warheads to be a very serious threat. The U.S. is also developing a number of hypersonics across the services. I'm learning that there was a test failure up in Alaska of one of them. So our path is a little bumpier in terms of deploying these things. And once they're deployed, there's no guarantee that they would deter an adversary from deployment or even use. So it's really a change from the way we're used to thinking of intercontinental hypersonic missiles with this new breed, and we're a little bit behind.
The launch took place in August. Is this the first time these officials in Washington learned of the launch, or have they been keeping quiet purposefully?
Well, that's sort of hard to say. This is the first time the Chinese government has said anything about it publicly. We do, the U.S. military, using a wide variety of different means, does keep very careful tabs on Chinese hypersonic development. So it's possible that it was known in August, but now the Chinese are talking about it because I think they feel very confident in the results and that they'll hold up to the scrutiny of Western intelligence agencies. And that is a somewhat worrisome sign. It's also sort of an intimidation sign. And when you think about what this is useful for in the grand strategy of things, it wasn't that long ago, actually, in March of this year, I talked to some different officials that were in charge of the area of China, the Asian Pacific, And it is the military's expectation that China may make a play for Taiwan within the next 5 years. This is something that's since come out on the record under Senate testimony, that expectation. So this is all part of a very large game of intimidation that will factor into, among other things, how we talk about Taiwan and its defendability, the value of defending it. This is all, it doesn't seem related, but it all is.
My favorite momentary story by Patrick Tucker. An M113 armored personnel carrier turned into a robot. I love this story. Immediately, I anthropomorphized the robot. Does it have a name? Does it talk back? Does it have a personality? What is the Army up to, Patrick?
Yes, the Army is proceeding very quickly with a new program to develop what they call unmanned combat vehicles. And in order to do that, they're taking a kind of novel approach. First, they're taking old M113s, basically big armored personnel carriers, and just seeing what sort of autonomous software they can stick on them to make them work. And next summer, they're going to stage the largest, what you can call a robot tank competition, if you take a somewhat liberal definition of the word tank. So sorry to, my combat vehicle nerds out there, but they're going to stage the largest ever robot tank experiment ever. And this is part of an effort to modernize a lot of things across the Army. But again, with the focus of deterring an adversary like China by showing that really they can execute different operations much faster through the use of automation, through the use of artificial intelligence, and spare a lot more U.S. soldier lives in the process. So that experiment is proceeding fairly well. And it really shows how the military is working to bring artificial intelligence to the front lines of any future conflict, where that works and where it doesn't. I think it's important to point out, too, that the Army has a different set of challenges than would Uber or Google or some Silicon Valley company trying to develop autonomous vehicles, because those companies can rely on a lot of bandwidth, a lot of communications back to great big cloud servers, running a lot of data through cellular networks or 5G. And the Army has to assume that whatever adversary they're facing, likely, these exercises are designed to mock or mimic China, if you will, that those communications will be jammed. So the robots that the Army is building have to be a lot smarter than the self-driving cars that might show up on the streets in the next few years, because they won't be able to phone home as easily.
And the Army has put this out for prototypes, right? They're under development now, a competition between manufacturers.
Yes. So there's two competitions, one to develop the software, that the brains that will fuel these things, that will make them actually run. And the Army is looking to have like sort of a software kernel, something that would be applicable across a whole lot of different vehicles. And there's also a competition to develop the hardware, the actual onboard circuitry, the tracks, the armor, et cetera, that would be the house for these brains. And there's two of those competitions that are proceeding side by side. And that way, as the brains continue to improve, to innovate as software does, much faster than hardware, you can just get, take that robot tank back to the shop and it gets a little bit smarter as it receives the update the same way your phone does.
And Patrick, I recall conversations we've had in the past. Is it still the opinion of the Department of Defense that there must be a human in the loop of a weapon system?
Yes, a human on the loop. So it has to have a human designates the target and sets the parameters upon which that target would be fired. And if there's something unexpected that comes in the way, then that's another issue. But that remains Defense Department doctrine. They do have an entire ethical principles list that guides not only how to deploy these things, but how to build them, how to test them, how to design them, to make sure that ethical principle is there. It's not just a matter of like feel goodedness. This is really kind of a key aspect of keeping allies like the French and the Germans willing to participate with us in exercises and possibly even conflict. So it's not just to appeal to people with sensibilities that are delicate. But I've talked to commanders and they think that it's going to just become increasingly hard to follow that if you get into a conflict where AI is really accelerating the pace of operations. So the way you avoid a situation where all of a sudden you have to take the human out of the loop so that you can keep up, so that you you don't lose, is you have to assume that the pace of operations is going to accelerate because of AI,
right,
and design all your systems accordingly. Because if you've gotten to the point where you're making quick ethical sacrifices to avoid defeat, then you've already kind of lost.
Patrick Tucker, technology editor, Defense One. This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.